I do want to say that normally we usually have dedications for this year in memory of people, and that of course creates a certain amount of sadness as people remember bereavements. But Baruch Hashem, today we have a dedication in honor of a simcha. We have a Mazel Tov sponsored by Judy Ziering in honor of her granddaughter's bas mitzvah, Gila Ziering, a Mazel Tov. May she continue to grow in Torah, Chupa, and Masim Tovim. Also, I wish everyone a wonderful Yom Yerushalayim. Some of you may have been here in 1967. Some of you heard about it in Chutz La'aretz, as I did. And some of you were not even born. But nevertheless, although I have read in the Israeli press that Yom Yerushalayim is an under-celebrated chag, even among, not only in the Haredim, but even among people who would normally celebrate Yom HaTzimut in a very big way, Yom Yerushalayim is a little de-emphasized, and of course that's very unfortunate to be Zocha, to not only have the old city, but more importantly even to have the Harabayat and to be able to worship Hashem at the last remnants where the Shechina never departed, the Kotel Maravi, and some people hold even the Harabayas itself, but I won't get into that halachic debate, is such a tremendous sechus, and there's no question that it brings us one step, maybe many steps, closer to the Geula Shlema. One very famous story that you may remember, you may have heard, is that when the Chayolim got to the Kotel, and they were crying, many of them were crying and sobbing as they were reunited with their beloved Yerushalayim. So there was a soldier who was very, very far from traditional Yiddishkeit, who was also crying. And one of his colleagues said, "What are you crying for?" So he said, "I'm crying because I don't know what they're crying for. And the fact is that I know there's something here, and I don't yet know what it is, but I will find out what it is, and I will discover what it is. Because it is my chalek as well. It is not just his chalek, it is my chalek." So even if you don't know what you're crying for, that's still a good reason to cry. I know that Rivka gave you a wonderful shir in Yerushalayim. I only came in towards the end. I just wanted to say something very, very quick. It's not my topic today, and I hope I'm not repeating. But you know, Yerushalayim is actually like Lahazil Minneapolis St. Paul. It is actually twin cities. It actually is a composite of two different cities. The original name of the city was Shalem. Malchisedek, the king of Shalem, brought Avraham Lechem V'Yayin after Avraham defeated the four kings. The word Salem, famous Salem witch trials, come from Shalem, that is the anglicized version of Shalem. Now, the other part of the city was Mount Moriah, the site of the Akedah, the Haravayit, which Avraham called Hashem Yireh. Hashem will look down at his people. So in short, that became known as Yireh. So the two parts of the city are Yireh, Shalem, and the Aleph and the Hay got combined into a Vav. So it's Yeru Shalem. And indeed, throughout Tanakh, the city is never written as Yerushalayim. It is always written without the last yud, Yerushalem. And in fact, the English Jerusalem corresponds to the phonetic way it is actually written in the Tanakh, without that extra yud. It is a combination of Yireh and Shalem. Now, the extra yud, Yerushalayim, I'm not sure if this is grammatically true or not, but the Svarim HaKadoshim say that just like Raglayim is plural, Aznayim is plural, Yadayim is plural, Yerushalayim are the two Jerusalems. And we do not mean east and west, because that's really one city, but we mean the Yerushalayim on earth and the Yerushalayim of Shamayim. And indeed, we hope very much that when the two cities are aligned together, there is Kedusha and there is Geula. But one point about the idea that Yerushalayim is a composite city, the Yireh and the Shalem, brings out a very, very important message. Yireh means God sees, But the same spelling also means Yirat Shamayim, fear of heaven, reverence, although that's not grammatically what it meant in that context. So on one hand, Yerushalayim is the city of reverence of God, fear of God, extreme passion for the Torah and for the mitzvahs. But it also must be the city of Shalom, the city of peace. Now, as I mentioned last week, often these two ideas are in tension. Sometimes the very source of many machloks in Yerushalayim is between those who are Yirei Hashem, who are trying to fight ideas that they think are not proper, but they do so in a manner that is inconsistent with Shalom. And in order to have Yerushalayim as a city that is Mechuvan, Keneged, Yerushalayim Shalmala, it is not enough to have the Yira. The Yira alone is not going to do it. It must be the Yira that is combined with the Shalem that creates Yerushalayim, which then be connected to the Yerushalayim Shalmala. So we have to remember in all of our lives that Yiras Shamayim and Shalom are not contradictions in terms, as is often the case, but in fact they have to go together as one single idea. That the greater a person's Yiras Shamayim, the more they are a Rodef Shalom. And if they seek to foster Machlokes and Sinas Chinam, then by definition there is something Pagum in the Yiras Shamayim. I just saw yesterday the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon writes in a pasuk in Mishlei that HaKadosh Baruch Hu loves. This is the Vilna Gaon, not a modern Orthodox rabbi or something. The Vilna Gaon writes, Hashem loves those who are Malamei Zechus on Bnei Yisrael, those who look at the Jewish people in a kind, benevolent way. That is the Ratzon Hashem. You know, it reminds me of a great story. Everyone knows the Satmar Rav, the famous Satmar Rav, who was an implacable foe of Zionism. I mean, basically, he was absolutely against Medinat Yisrael. But there's a very, very funny story. When Hubert Humphrey was running for president in 1967, right after Lyndon Johnson, he was running for, or 68, running for the presidential election. So he was a very strong supporter of Israel all the way back to 48 and before that. And, you know, he thought he would get the Jewish vote. He was a staunch Zionist. And he had heard that there was a large community of Jews in Williamsburg, in Brooklyn. And he arranged a campaign stop in Williamsburg. And they didn't really tell him what the orientation of the community was, but it was a Satmar Hasidim. And the Rebbe was there, and there was a Meturgeman to translate. And Humphrey goes on and on about how Zionism is the greatest thing that ever happened, and the Jews have to have their state after all of these years of persecution, and he will, you know, he will never abandon the state of Israel, the only democracy in the Middle East. You know, this is Satmar, everything, you know, the Satmar was totally against it. And the Satmar Rebbe is like nodding and smiling. And afterwards, one of his aides kind of understood. One of his aides was Jewish, but he had not been consulted, and he was abhorred. He was shocked. Hey, Vayimir, we're going to lose 100,000 votes in New York because of this speech. So he went to the Rebbe afterwards, and he apologized. He said, you know, Humphrey, what do you want, a Geisha cup? You know, he doesn't know. He doesn't understand the nuances of Hasidus. He says, please, please forgive, you know, to understand that he has a good heart. So the Satmar Rebbe said, there was nothing wrong with what he said at all. He said, I have many, many machloksim with the Israelis, but this is a family dispute. This is a disagreement within the family. And you love your family even when you disagree with them. And Hans Fishalom, if my family is in danger, says, I'm not in favor of the state of Israel. He said, if things would be peaceful, I would say dismantle the state. And this was his position. But if the Jewish people in Israel are in danger from enemies that want to destroy them, then I want them to have the weapons to protect themselves against their enemies. So if Humphrey is talking about selling arms to allow Israel to protect itself, Gesundheit, I may disagree with the edifice they've created, but this is a family fight. And in your family, you love your family. Now I have to say, as is often the case, some of the disciples do not continue the Mahalach of the Rebbe, but this was the Shita of the Rebbe. And to give you another story illustrating this, somebody once went to the Rebbe, Satmar Rav, and had the chutzpah to be a little critical of him. He said, you know, how come you're so negative on everybody? You know, Avram Avinu was begging Hashem to spare the city of Sodom Sodom, people who were, you know, Mushkasim, Rishayim, people who did the worst possible Averos. And Avram is seeking Hashem's mercy on them. And the Rebbe is critical not only of, let's say, secular Zionism, he's critical of Aguda, and there was no Degel HaTorah then, but even the very religious people, Tzadikim, Talmidei Chachamim, says, are they worse than Sodom? They don't deserve the same consideration Avram gave to Sodom. So the Rebbe said, Avram sought mercy when he was talking to God. When he had to deal with the actual Sodomites, he may have given them Musar and Hadracha and guidance. So the Satmar Rebbe said, how do you know what I say to Hashem when I'm davening to Hashem? Two different things. There's a certain public position because he felt he had to communicate, and I'm not getting into the merits of the underlying art, separate issue. But I just want to show that even the person, let's say, who might be exemplified as the greatest of the zealots, was a person who still had Avas Yisrael and saw that as part of his avoda. And this is something, again, I don't want to be self-righteous, because this is something that all of us, including myself, have to work on. But this is certainly a very, very, very serious problem of our generation that we have to deal with, in which the zealousness and the conviction of the rightness of our cause often turns into such a sinna and such a hatred and such a demonization and such a delegitimation of other shittas. You know, somebody, one of my talmidim actually told me a very, very nice vort on this, which I had not heard before. By Kriyas Yamsuf, each shevet had its own pathway. We know this. But there's a medrash that says that the pathway was glass or ice, so you could see what the other person was doing. So he said, in the name of someone, that the lesson is that even if you have your own individual derech and you're not following the other derech, you should be able to see the validity of the other derech. Meaning it shouldn't just be a stone wall in which you have no connection to what that other derech is doing. You should be able to see that derech. You should be able to appreciate that derech. And certainly, on the day of Yom Yerushalayim, which is Ki'ir Shechubra Lo Yachta, but you said the city that has come together, both in terms of east and west, and old and new, and Yerushalayim of Mata, with Yerushalayim Shalmala, certainly one of the dreams that we can have is to make it a community where indeed we come together in different ways. And Bezras Hashem, that will bring the Gola, because that's a Devar Pashut. If the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of sinas chinam, because of hatred, disunity, fragmentation, it will be rebuilt when there is unity. That's exactly it. When we remove the reason for the destruction of the Mikdash, we are zocha to the binyan of the Mikdash. You know, Josephus, Yosef ben Matisyo, who was an eyewitness to the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. Again, Josephus is a controversial person. Some regard him as the Jewish Benedict Arnold, because he surrendered to the Romans and he wrote his history from the vantage point of living in Rome under the protection of the emperor. On the other hand, you can even look at it a different way. Josephus's hashkafa was the same as Chazal's, because Chazal were also against waging war with Rome. Remember Yochanan ben Zakkai. So, in a sense, Josephus, who didn't want to wage war, is kind of in the same boat. But be it as it may, however you look at him, obviously almost everything he says in his history of the Jewish war against Rome has to be taken with an enormous grain of salt, because he was literally writing with a gun to his head. He was writing it in Rome, and he really couldn't say too many bad things about Rome. That is why Titus is really a good guy, etc. Whatever. In other words, he describes Titus in a very positive way. And he says, Titus did not want to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. It was the rowdy soldiers that made him do it, etc. Okay, this stuff could be just what he had to write. But there's one thing he does write that I think has the ring of truth, although I don't know. I was not there, not that old. And he writes that at one point Titus was surveying all of the infighting among the Jews in Yerushalayim. There was a war party and there was a peace party and there were different factions. And this is true. The Gemara itself talks about this. So he quotes Titus as saying, you know, I really don't have to destroy this city. If I just wait long enough, they will do it for me. And he actually quotes Titus as saying this, and I suspect, based on the fact that Chazal say, sinas chinam, I suspect that perhaps that actually was an accurate quote. Very, very amazing that even Titus HaRasha saw that phenomenon within Yerushalayim, and to some degree we have it even today. So these are some things we could think about on Yom Yerushalayim, and to really try to make this Ki'ir Shechubra La Yachta, especially during the period of Sfira. But as we're approaching the last week of the Omer, I wanted to share with you a very interesting observation of the Meshech Chochmah. That is, all of us know that the mitzvah of counting the Omer, by the way, I'm totally disoriented with the arrangement here, but okay, this is a new... See, part of the disadvantage is that I don't have a clock that I have. So if I go late, forgive me, but okay. I see you walking out, I know that it's time. Anyway, but it says, by Sfira Saomer, Usvartim Lachem Mimacharas HaShabbos. You start counting from the day after Shabbos. Now we know that this was a major, major machlokas for hundreds of years between the Prushim, the Pharisees, who in the Christian Bible are the bad guys, but the Pharisees are Chazal, the Prushim, and the Tzedukim, the followers of Tzadik and Baisais, who did not believe in the Torah Shebaal Peh. And the Prushim took the position that you always start counting the Omer the second day of Pesach, and when it says the day after Shabbos, it means, Shabbos means Pesach, which is a Yom Tov that you cannot do Malacha. The Tzedukim, however, took the position that Shabbos meant Saturday, as it normally means, and the counting of the Omer always starts on the Sunday, the first Sunday after Pesach or within Pesach. Now, this year, by the way, interestingly enough, still maybe it's a harbinger of Achdus. The Tzedukim and the Prushim come together because everybody starts counting the Omer the same time. The Karaites, who still exist in small number, follow these Tzeduki practice of counting the Omer from a Sunday. So this year, everybody has Shavuos the same day. But in most years, that wasn't the case. And this was a big, big machlokas, that for hundreds of years, the Chachamim had to go to great lengths to try to establish that the meaning of Shabbos is Pesach, and Svira is Mimacharas HaShabbos, the day after Pesach, the day after the first day of Pesach, and not Sunday. Ad kedei kach, that when Pesach was on Shabbos, and the first day of Svira was on Sunday, they tried to de-emphasize some of the festivities in order that people shouldn't think it was a permanent thing. So the question becomes, Rav Meir Simcha asks, if indeed the meaning of Shabbos is the first day of Pesach, why does the Torah use the ambiguous term Shabbos? Because Shabbos, most of the time, means Saturday. Now, of course, one has to ask, well, what should it have said? What would have been better than Shabbos? So you might think superficially, oh, the thing that would have been better is Pesach, say Mimacharat HaPesach, the day after Pesach. But that wouldn't work, because that would have given you the wrong day. Pesach B'Lashon HaTorah is never the 15th of Nisan. Pesach B'Lashon HaMikra is the 14th of Nisan, the day that you bring the Korban Pesach. So if it would have said Mimacharat HaPesach, you would have said Pesach is 14, Mimacharas is 15, and you would have started counting the Omer on the 15th. So one might say, if the Torah wanted to emphasize that you start on the 16th, it has to say, the day after a day that you were shovet, that you refrained from doing malacha. So Macharas HaPesach is no good. But on the other hand, if Mimacharas HaPesach is no good, Mimacharas HaShabbos is ambiguous. So if you want to resolve ambiguity, let the Torah just use a date. Let the Torah say, "Bayom Shisha Asar LaChodesh HaRishon," the 16th day of the first month, which is Nisan, Tisperu Chamishim Yom, start Usvartim Lachem. In other words, don't say Mimacharas HaShabbos and don't say Mimacharas HaPesach. Give a specific date. So why does the Torah go out of its way to use the ambiguous term Shabbos? So the Meshech Chachma says the following explanation. If we look at the distinction between Shabbos and Yom Tov, we find two halakhic distinctions. Halakhic distinction number one is that on Yom Tov there is a heter called Ochel Nefesh, right? You're allowed to do malacha for food preparation, like cooking. In fact, even if it's not always for food, things that you need for Yom Tov you're allowed to carry. Now it's complicated, not every malacha is permitted, but there's a generic heter called Ochel Nefesh that allows you to cook, allows you to carry, allows you to transfer fire that's already in existence, to raise or lower fires if necessary for cooking. This is called Ochel Nefesh, that which the soul needs to eat. That is only mutter on Yom Tov. That is not mutter on Shabbos. On Shabbos, you can only do malacha if it's literally a matter of life and death, only if it's pikuach nefesh. That is distinction number one. Distinction number two is the mechanism of holiness. The holiness of Shabbos does not depend on us. Even if, God forbid, there would not be a single Jew who kept Shabbos, the holiness of Shabbos would still be here. Mekadesh Berechata Hashem, Mekadesh HaShabbos. It is God who sanctifies the Shabbos. By contrast, the holiness of Yom Tov is very different. The holiness of Yom Tov comes only because the Sanhedrin sanctifies the new moon, and the Yom Tov will be X number of days after the new moon, or in the case of Rosh Hashanah, on the day of the new moon. And the Mishnah tells us, even if astronomically the Sanhedrin sanctified the wrong day, the Moadim are counted from the erroneous date that they sanctified and not from the astronomical reality of Rosh Chodesh. This is a very, very famous Mishnah where Rabban Gamliel and the Sanhedrin sanctified a certain day as Rosh Hashanah based on witnesses. Rabbi Yoshua had proven that the witnesses were liars and Rosh Hashanah should be the next day. And Rabban Gamliel ordered him to come on the day that he thought was Yom Kippur, which would be the day after Yom Kippur, and desecrate Yom Kippur by carrying money. And Rabbi Yoshua was very upset. He didn't know what to do. And Rabbi Akiva told him, even if they got it wrong, the holiness of Yom Tov and Yom Kippur is based on their Kiddush HaChodesh. And that is why the Avudram tells us that the Nusach of the Shabbos Bracha is Baruch Atah Hashem Mekadesh HaShabbos, Hashem sanctifies Shabbos. The Nusach of the Yom Tov Bracha is Mekadesh Yisrael V'Hazmanim. He sanctifies Am Yisrael, which then, through the Sanhedrin, has the koach to be Mekadesh Zmanim. It's very meduyak, and that is why when it's Shabbos and Yom Tov, you have to follow the sequence. Baruch Atah Hashem, Mekadesh HaShabbos, VeYisrael, VeHazmanim. You don't say Mekadesh Yisrael, VeHashabbos, VeHazmanim. Mekadesh HaShabbos, VeYisrael, VeHazmanim. Now, this raises the obvious question you might ask. Well, wait a second. If the holiness of Yom Tov depends on the Sanhedrin sanctifying the new moon, and it does not depend on the astronomical reality of the lunar appearance every month, then today we don't have a Sanhedrin. Today we don't have the ceremony of Kiddush HaChodesh. So why is there Yom Tov at all? So in reality, if you look in the Rambam says that the only reason we keep Yomim Tovim today is the last Sanhedrin, knowing that they would shortly be abolished. And by the way, the Sanhedrin lasted hundreds of years after the Beis HaMikdash. It is not totally on the Beis HaMikdash. It is totally on people that have unbroken ordination from Moshe Rabbeinu, which we don't have today. And that lasts. But the last Sanhedrin calculated the Jewish calendars. They calculated all of the Rosh Chodesh until the year 6000. on the theory that Mashiach will for sure come before then, and they sanctified those months in advance. And that is why we have Yom Tov. And if for some reason, this won't happen of course, but if for some reason Mashiach would not come by the year 6000, we would no longer be keeping Yom Tov. There would be no Rosh Hashanah, no Yom Kippur, no Sukkot, no Pesach, no Shavuos, because there's no Kiddush HaChodesh. There can't be Kedushas Yom Tov without Kiddush HaChodesh. This is the position of the Rambam, as opposed to Shabbos, which will continue to exist. Now, the interesting, so now what do we have? So we've like, the Rebbe Simcha has identified two distinctions, again, to recapitulate, between Shabbos and Yom Tov. One is Ochel Nefesh, and the other is the source of the holiness. Shabbos comes from Hashem, Yom Tov comes from us. Now, one final point before I leave this, and that is, Friday night, Shabbos day, we recite something called Kiddush. And Kiddush seems to be sanctification. Does that not indicate that we are sanctifying Shabbos? The answer has to be no. Kiddush means we are acknowledging the holiness that Hashem put into the day, but we are not sanctifying the day. We are acknowledging God's holiness. Indeed, Kiddush itself ends, Baruch Atah Hashem Mikadesh HaShabbos. So Kiddush of Shabbos is not the same as Kiddush HaChodesh. Kiddush HaChodesh, we are actually creating the sanctity. Hashem puts the holiness into the world based on our activity. The Kiddush of Shabbos is we are just acknowledging what Hashem put into the Bria already. Now, if these are the two distinctions between Shabbos and Yom Tov, Rav Meir Simcha suggests that these might be explained by a third distinction that would be a common denominator that will explain the other two, and that is the following. Shabbos represents an ideal that has nothing to do with the Jewish people intrinsically. There is nothing intrinsic to Shabbos that is connected to the Jewish people. Shabbos commemorates the idea that God created the world in 6 days and God rested. And to acknowledge that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the source of all creation, we refrain from our technological mastery of the world for that one day out of 7. Shabbos is about Emunah and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What does that have to do with the Jewish people? A non-Jew also has to believe in God. A non-Jew also has to accept that God created heaven and earth. Shabbos as a concept is a universalistic idea that is not mekushar to the historical events that befell the Jewish people. It happens to be Hashem in his rachamim gave us Shabbos as a gift. That is why Shabbos is called a gift. The Medrash tells us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Matana achas yesh li bebeis kenazai, I have a precious gift in my treasure house. V'Shabbos Shema. A gift is something you didn't earn, you don't deserve, you don't work for. It is something b'chinam. Shabbos is a matnas chinam. Because Shabbos is a matnas chinam, that is why it does not bend for us. That is why our needs don't override Shabbos, because we didn't create Shabbos. Shabbos existed independent of Am Yisrael, and therefore it doesn't bend for us. And that is why we do not control its sanctity. Its sanctity comes from God. By contrast, Yomim Tovim exist only because of Hashem's encounters with Am Yisrael. If there would not have been a Yitzias Mitzrayim, there would not have been a Pesach. If there would not have been a Matan Torah, there would not have been a Shavuos. If there would not have been the forgiveness of the Chet HaEgel, There wouldn't have been Yom Kippur. If there wouldn't have been the clouds of glory, which is the gift as a result of our forgiveness, there wouldn't have been Sukkot. The only holiday in which, you notice I skipped one holiday, in which the uniquely Jewish connection is a little hard to discern is Rosh Hashanah. Because Rosh Hashanah as a Yom Tov per se is not miyuchad to Am Yisrael, because that commemorates the day that Adam HaRishon was created. Of course, in later years, some say Rosh Hashanah was the day of Akedas Yitzchak, so that may create a special connection. On the other hand, that's not so pashut. There are a number of Midrashim that say that Avram sacrificed Yitzchak, or was willing to sacrifice Yitzchak on Yom Kippur. Some move the Akedah to Yom Kippur, some give it even another day. Okay, but putting aside Rosh Hashanah, which maybe raises a question, Rav Meir Simcha says, Yomim Tovim exist only because of us. Without us, there wouldn't have been Yom Tov. So because Yom Tov exists because of Am Yisrael, that is why Yom Tov becomes subservient to the needs of Am Yisrael. We can cook, we can carry, because Yom Tov owes its very existence to us. And since Yom Tov owes its very existence to us, it becomes nullified to our needs, which, by the way, explains why you cannot cook for a guy on Yom Tov, because the nullification of Yom Tov is for our needs. And that also explains why Klal Yisrael is the source of the sanctification of Yom Tov. Because if Yom Tov owes its life to us, that is why we have a control, we have a shalita, we have a mastery over how you bring Kedusha into the world. So far, you're following, meaning Rav Meir Simcha identified two distinctions between Shabbos and Yom Tov, Ochel Nefesh and the Kiddush HaChodesh, and he explained those two distinctions by reference to a third idea, that Shabbos is a universalistic concept that was given to us as a gift that we didn't deserve. Yom Tov stems exclusively, putting aside the Rosh Hashanah problem, stems exclusively from the historical encounter that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has with the Jewish people, and that is why Yom Tov depends on us, that is why we sanctify Yom Tov, that is why there's a heter of Ochel Nefesh. Okay. So, if we now understand that Shabbos represents the unearned gift that was given to us as an act of grace, but Yom Tov owes its existence to us, of all the Yomim Tovim in the Jewish calendar, Pesach is the most Shabbistic. Pesach is the closest to the idea of Shabbos. On one hand, it's not Shabbos in the sense that it's only because of Yetzias Mitzrayim that there is a Yom Tov. But on the other hand, Pesach represents a redemption that we didn't earn, we didn't deserve, we should have been there 400 years. Hashem took us out 190 years early, because had we stayed even another second, we would have hit the 49th level, we would have hit the 50th level of impurity, and we would have been gone. It was something that we were, arum v'yeriyah, we were naked from mitzvah. Hashem had to give us some extra mitzvahs. So Pesach represents a matnat chinam, an unearned gift. Unlike Shavuos, where we had worked on ourselves to be for 49 days to prepare for Matan Torah. Unlike Yom Kippur, where we did the Avodah of Tshuva to be forgiven for the Chet Egel, unlike Sukkot, which is the gift of the Anani HaKavod, which is really the glow after the forgiveness of Yom Kippur, Pesach was a madrega that was beyond our spiritual level. Hashem gave us something, gave us a light, which we were really not worthy of at the time. In fact, remember, even at Kriyas Yamsuf, the Yom Tov said to Hashem, why save the Jewish people and kill the Egyptians? They are no better than the Egyptians. And Hashem had to answer, you're right. Right now they're no better. But there'll be a Matan Torah and the like. So Pesach is called Shabbos because it also represents a Matnas Chinam. Now, based on this idea, we can take this to a next step, which Rav Meir Simcha doesn't do. That is, people ask the kasha. We know that the basic idea of counting the Omer is to connect the holiday of freedom with the holiday of Torah, Pesach and Shavuot, to make it one long Yom Tov, because freedom has a value only when it's connected to Torah. Right? We talked about that last week. But the question is, if that's the case, again, I think I may have mentioned Tagore's metaphor, that the human soul is like a violin string. Only when it's tied down and disciplined can it express the beautiful music within. A totally free string, a loose string on the kitchen table, will not produce any music. It's a beautiful, beautiful mashal for the notion that submission to Hashem is how the music and beauty in our neshama gets expressed. But the question is, I don't think we talked about this question, is, okay, so why don't you start counting the Omer the first day of Pesach? Why me Machlas? Why the second day of Pesach? Do it the first day. So the Sefer HaChinuch says, Sefer HaChinuch asks the kasha, and the Sefer HaChinuch says, well, we have a general rule. We don't like to mix one simcha with another simcha. You don't make a chasna during Chol HaMoed, etc. So we don't want to start thinking about the next Yom Tov when I'm in the middle of the Pesach Seder. That would take away from the joy of the Pesach Seder. But that's a little bit of a difficult answer, because it's not really a separate simcha. It's not like, you know, making a chasna the night of the Seder or something, which you're not allowed to do. Here, the purpose of the freedom is Matan Torah. So why wouldn't I do it the first night of Pesach? So here, I want to share with you a thought from Rav Nachman of Breslov, who was the Baal Shem Tov's grandson, and he actually quotes this in the name of his grandfather, the Baal Shem Tov. And he raises a very interesting question. He says, when a person is new to Yiddishkeit, a person is Chozer B'Tshuva, there is such an excitement in so many things. Every Shabbos is beautiful, every tefillah is nice, keeping kosher is inspirational, and even the sacrifices, a person relishes the sacrifices. One sees meaning and purpose. And yet, what happens, as often happens in life, is that as you get more and more habituated in these things, it really doesn't mean so much anymore. And not only that, but it gets a little burdensome. Now, why should that be so? Now, you might answer, well, that's what life is all the time. Whenever you do the same thing over and over again, it gets boring. But that doesn't make sense spiritually. Because if mitzvahs bring you closer to God, how can it be? How could God make a mechanism where the more I do, the less I get out of it? How can it be that the more Shabbos I keep, the less each Shabbos gives to me? That's perverse. That kind of means that when I keep the mitzvos, I'm getting further and further from Hashem, which doesn't make any sense at all. Right? This is the dilemma. So the Baal Shem Tov gave the following mashal. When a baby's learning how to walk, and the baby initially can't walk, but at some point, the baby stands up, and the parents support the baby under his or her arms, and the baby takes a step, and a step, and another step. And the baby's making good progress. And at some point, the parents are going to let go to see if the baby could do it on his own. And what's immediately going to happen is plop, plop, plop. Baby's going to fall down. Now, of course, children learning how to walk or even how to crawl is really one of the most amazing things. And obviously many of you have noticed it, if you don't remember from your own life. And that is, no matter how many times the kid falls down, he gets up. Or even in crawling, you know, every time when a child begins to crawl, it's physically so hard that he's straining and pulling. Say, what are you straining? Who's telling you to do this? Just relax, play with the ball. You see an amazing thing? Hashem put into that neshama the desire to move, the desire to grow, the desire to accomplish, not to give up no matter what happens. That's the koach Hashem put into us. And that's a koach that every one of us has even today. But what happens is, as we get older, we forget that part of childhood. And we give up. Things aren't so easy. Things don't go so well. So we give up on our dreams. We give up on the desire to accomplish things. But the Bodhicitta used to say, look at that child learning how to walk, learning how to crawl. Nothing will stop that person. No, short of, God forbid, actual physical disability. But psychologically, there is going to be no impediment at all. There is something, a koach ha-dochef, that pushes that child forward. But be it as it may, though, the kid is falling down now. Now, if this child could verbalize his frustration, excuse me, using his, I mean his, her, but yeah, I'm going to use just because of convenience, the question is, how come 2 minutes ago it was so easy, and now it's unfailing? I'm only, 2 years old, I'm already a failure. What's going on? And the answer is, it was so easy because your parents were supporting you. But now you're ready for the next challenge, in which you internalize, make your own, what your parents showed you you're capable of doing. The Baal Shem Tov says, this is tremendous, the Baal Shem Tov says, this is exactly the process of tshuva. When a person is initially very far from God, it is very hard for them to come to Hashem and His mitzvos. So God carries them artificially. He lifts them up. And when Hashem lifts them up, everything is joyous, everything is beautiful, everything is vivid. But then, like a parent, Hashem says, I've shown you what you're able to be. I've shown you what your life can become. But now I'm going to put you down at the base of the mountain. And it's your job to become it. So counterintuitively, Rav Nachman says, and this is a typical Breslover insight, a very good Breslover insight, that when a person faces spiritual struggle in their life, it is a sign of God's confidence in them. When life is going well, basically Hashem is holding on to you, meaning you're not strong enough to take it. When a person has these crises, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is actually telling them, you're ready now to take what I've shown you and make it your own. It's Hashem's vote of confidence in you. That's how one looks at the struggles, the spiritual struggles of life going up and down. So now, the Baal HaTanya, who does not quote Rav Nachman, but uses a very similar idea to explain this, says, that is Pesach and that is Shavuos. Pesach is the Shabbos of Hashem showing me levels I did not earn, I did not deserve. That is why it says that the maidservants, the lowly maidservants, saw in the Yamsuf what even the Navi Yecheskel didn't see. That is why Pesach is called a Geula of Kefitza V'Dilug. Kefitza is jumping over the intermediate steps. Normally, spirituality is a process. You take little steps. Pesach Hashem jumped us over all sorts of levels, like a private in the army becoming a general overnight. But you skipped all the middle steps. Sevira is we start from the bottom. And in slow, incremental ways, we try to achieve within our lives that which Hashem gave us as a gift on Pesach. And that is why the Baal HaTanya says the counting of the Omer is the day after Shabbos. Shabbos, i.e. Pesach, is the unearned gift, where Hashem shows you what you can be spiritually. But then there's a macharas, there's a next day. The next day, like the day after the wedding, we say, the day after the wedding is when real life begins. Now, I understand that Pesach is physically a very, very hard holiday. You might be thinking, well, what do I mean, unearned gift? We worked plenty hard for Pesach. All of that is very, very true. But it does mean, in an optimal sense, now again, not all of us achieve this, but in theory at least, Pesach is a time when Hashem can enable our neshamas to absorb Kedusha that is above our natural madrega. That is called Kafitza V'Diluk. It's based on a pasuk in Shir HaShirim. Medaleg al Haharim. God skips over the mountains. Mikapetz al Hagvaot. He jumps over the hills. So the two words there are Kafitza V'Diluk. And the Medrash tells us Harim are the Avot, in the merit of the patriarchs, and Gevaot are Imahot. But so the Kitzer, Pesach is referred to as the Kafitza V'Diluk, the gift that's beyond your capacity. Svira is called the Geula of Hadraga, of going incrementally from level to level. And the Balatanya says, this is Marumas in Shir HaShirim, which is, of course, you know, Shir HaShirim, as you know, is a very, very controversial book banned in Boston, so to speak. There were Chachamim who did not want Shir HaShirim to be part of Tanakh because they saw it as love poetry, God forbid, pornographic love poetry or somewhat risque love poetry. But we have to credit Rabbi Akiva for recognizing that Shir HaShirim is the great metaphor for the love that Hashem has for the Jewish people, and that the Jewish people have for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And everything has to be understood as a mashal. And Rabbi Akiva said that if all of the Shirim are Kodesh, all of the songs in Tanakh are Kodesh, Shir HaShirim is Kodesh Kedoshim. I'll have some more words about that at the end, but in the beginning of Shir HaShirim, the young woman says to her lover, her beloved one, Moshcheni acharecha, pull me after you, narutza, so we can run together. So the Zohar says, pull me after you is a reference to Pesach. And narutza is a reference to Shavuos. How so? Because Moshcheni basically means I'm passive. You're pulling me like a sack of potatoes. Pesach, we were not worthy of redemption. Pull me! But in Sviras HaOmer, I gain my own spiritual powers. Narutza, I run with God. There is what is called reciprocity. God gives me, but I give back to Hashem by doing Torah, by doing mitzvot, etc., by perfecting myself, I give back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's Narutza, we run together. There's a certain reciprocity in the relationship. Now, of course, I understand, in a real sense, we give God nothing, because everything we give Hashem, ultimately He already has. But the one thing Hashem wants to do, as the Sfarim say, is to give us bracha. So when we make ourselves the best that we can be, we're making ourselves worthy of bracha, we're giving Hashem nachas. So, l'chalapachas, we're giving Hashem the nachas in his children. So that's, again, the idea of bimacharas, that Sfiras HaOmer is the idea that HaKadosh Baruch Hu artificially gives us insights that are way beyond us to show us what our potential is. But then the job in life is become it. No, it's the same thing. You know, everyone knows the famous Gemara that before a child is born, the Malach, there's an angel who teaches the child all of the Torah. Although, it's interesting, I saw the Gra. The Gra actually says, it doesn't mean all of the Torah. It's very interesting. It says, all of the Torah that's connected to your unique neshama, meaning everyone is a different chelik of Torah. It really refers to the Torah that's connected to your neshama. And then, before the child is born, right, you remember the malach hits the child on the lip, and all of that Torah is forgotten. By the way, we are told we will see that malach one more time. Right before our death, the malach comes back to see if we relearned all that he taught us before we were born. Kind of the teacher comes back to see if we internalized the lesson. But people ask two questions. Number one, why do I have to lose the Torah? Why can't I hold on to it? Why do I have to forget it? Answer, because what you get in life without effort isn't worth very much. So the Torah that you simply learned in the womb doesn't really count. It's only what you learn, what you do through your bechira. But then the question becomes the opposite. So why bother learning it in the first place? The answer is, they say, I have not tested this, that once you know how to ride a bike, you never forget. I could do an experiment, but I'm scared the principle might not be true, so I don't want to take a check. But they say that once, you know, things that we've learned, even if we've forgotten them totally, they're kind of imprinted on our subconscious. And they come back to us. Hashem put the Torah in our neshamas so that even when I forget it, but it's there. And when I encounter it again, it's not something new. It's a deja vu phenomenon. It's something that on a spiritual level, even not in a cognitive level, is familiar. It creates the receptivity. If I wouldn't have been imprinted with it, the Torah would have been foreign to me. It would have been strange to me. Hashem wanted my neshama to feel comfortable and connected to this. And therefore, he put it in the neshama, but he then took away the cognitive awareness so that I gain it through my own effort. One final point about Shir HaShirim. You know, Shir HaShirim, of course, as I say, was a very controversial biblical book, because it talks about the man-woman relationship. As a result, as you may know, although I have great admiration for Art School, they do tremendous work. People like to insult Art School all the time, and Chas V'Shalom, they're worthy of great admiration. But one of the controversial things that Art School did was they did not provide a literal translation of Shir HaShirim. Now the truth is, they did in the commentary. In the commentary there is little, but at least in the translation, they only use the mashal, the nimshal rather, they don't use the mashal. So, if it says, for example, and I excuse my language, if it says, he ravishes me with passionate kisses, so they will say, when Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim, there were 10 makos. You know, so, when you read the Art Scroll, you're wondering, gee, what's the big fuss here? You know, this is just, in fact, it's not even that inspiring necessarily. It's describing all the stuff that's in the Torah already. So Art Scroll says in its defense, well, we don't want to say things that'll be misunderstood, that'll be misinterpreted, so we want to give, you know, people understand this is not sexual imagery and the like. All right. But here's my question. Shlomo HaMelech is the Chacham Mikol Adam. Shlomo HaMelech is the wisest of all people. So why wasn't he as smart as Art Scroll? Meaning Shlomo HaMelech did write with that imagery. Shlomo HaMelech did use all of those ideas or metaphors or images that can be misunderstood, God forbid. Why did he do that? Why didn't he write it the way Art Scroll translated it? The answer to this question can actually be found in the Art Scroll Shir HaShirim in a Hebrew letter which they did not translate. One of their haskamos was a haskama from Rav Gifter, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, which they did not translate for some reason. And Rav Gifter actually says, why does Shlomo HaMelech use this language? And Rav Gifter says, because even though human passionate love is a metaphor for divine love, Shlomo HaMelech is teaching, you are not capable of understanding the metaphor unless you can internalize it in a literal sense. The literal sense is actually quite important. Meaning, if one is not capable of passionate human love, one cannot love God. Because God is not an abstraction. Our love of Hashem is tied into our ability to love other human beings. And therefore, it is a mashal for a higher nimshal. But without the mashal, you will not reach the nimshal. Okay, that's a very important thing. Now, you can't love God as an abstraction. Loving God has to be manifest in the day-to-day human relationships. You know, there are people say about politicians sometimes who are very much into causes. They want to give money for this cause, this cause, this cause, but they may not be kind to their families, they may not be kind to their secretaries, to the janitors. They're committed to a global cause. There's a story they tell about Leo Tolstoy, the author of War and Peace. who was a big social reformer. He was a count. He was a count in the Tsarist aristocracy. He had serfs. But he wrote a number of pamphlets calling for the abolition of serfdom. So somebody asked him, Count Tolstoy, you know, you always write about the rights of man, freedom, liberty. You call for the abolition of slavery. You consider it to be evil. Why do you have slaves? And he said, and he was well aware of the cynicism in his remark, he said, just because I'm a lover of humanity doesn't mean I have to care about people. The two are not related in any way. And he basically meant people are committed to the cause, but it doesn't translate into the here and now. And one of the important lessons of Shir HaShirim is how you have to start by loving, you start loving Hashem by the individual decisions that we make in the day-to-day and the life. Okay, so that is why Shlomo HaMelech did not write Shir HaShirim the way Art Scroll translated it. Okay, anyway, I want to wish you all a beautiful Yom Yerushalayim and Ezra Hashem a wonderful Yom Tov of Kabbalah's HaTorah. May all of us be Zocha to be Naseh V'Nishma V'Yidurah. Oh.